Okay, let's open our Bibles up again to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I have learned my lesson about feeding a meal after a church service. You've been consumed with the preparation of the meal, and now that you have some downtime, your mind is going to be consumed with the consumption of the meal. You may deny this and consider yourself more spiritual than others, but I've been looking at a lot more church members while I preach than you have, and I am convinced that this is a true fact. And so I've learned from that. Before, I used to dig my bullheaded preacher feet in the ground and say, well, bless the Lord, I'm just going to preach an extra amount of time and break them from this. But as I've gotten older, I've become a little more gentle and understanding. So I've cut my sermon in half. I was going to look at verses 1 through 7. Now we're going to look at verses 1 through 3. Now I want us to focus on these three verses. And I want us to have this thought in our mind as we read them. When the main ingredient is missing. Now before we read this text, I want to ask you, some of you ladies or you men, if you cook, have you ever embarked on a recipe and then realized you didn't have the main ingredient that you thought you had? I just assume sometimes in the kitchen at our house that I have flour, because we buy flour in big bags, and I just assume to have flour. And I have got out oil and buttered a dish and prepared to make biscuits and got everything down, even had the buttermilk to make them with, only to realize I have no flour. And I'm here to tell you, without flour, there will be no biscuits. It does not happen. And that's the main ingredient in biscuits. You can't make hamburger helper without the hamburger. I mean, these things are required in order for you to be able to turn out any kind of a product resembling that which is desired. Now, as we look at this text in chapter 13, it's often referred to as the love chapter. And it deals with love and its necessary place in our lives. And love is the main ingredient in the church. I know that Christ must dwell in your heart. But when Christ dwells in the heart of a believer, He brings love, not only for God, but love for His fellow believer and installs it in the heart of every person He's ever saved. If love is missing, it doesn't matter how gifted you are, you're pretty much useless. Okay, let's look at these three verses. I have four thoughts. We'll go through them and have Thanksgiving dinner. Sound like a good plan? All right. Verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as sounding brass or tinkling cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Now the first obstacle, I guess, we're going to have to overcome is this word charity. You can look in some modern translations and it's translated charity. You can look in some translations that predate the King James, and some of them are charity and some of them are love. But whether it's charity or whether it's love, I want you to understand the meaning of this word that's translated charity in the King James is love. I think any close reading of verse 3 where Paul talks about giving goods to the poor, he's not referring to charitable work. He's talking about love. How can you give to charity without charity, unless charity means love? I think love is the proper rendering. Do you agree? Hey, if you don't, I can hold up lunch as long as you want to. We can argue about it. But if we're all on the same page, I'm going to be referring to love instead of almsgiving, as some translators and some commentators like to refer to it. The word charity here, every time that we read it, is referring to love. Love. The first place that Paul throws out is an example. Now, love is required in all places, in all aspects of our life, but Paul gives us four areas of our life where love, these are examples, these are not a complete list. These are examples of places in your life, gifts that you have, that if you don't have love, they're no good. They're useless. The first thing that Paul addresses is our communication. Communication. Verse 1 deals with communication. When you look at verse 1, he's talking about tongues, and he's not talking about a dog's tongue that licks you in the face when you're about to fall asleep. He's talking about our language. Let's read verse 1 again. Though I speak with the tongues of men and the tongues of angels and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass and a tinkling cymbal. Point number one, communication. What does it mean to have the tongues of men? He's talking about the languages of men. Notice that the word tongues is plural with an S. Man speaks in a number of different languages. And there is definitely a language barrier. Have you ever been into a foreign country where they spoke a different language? Have you ever been frustrated by trying to communicate with someone that doesn't speak your language? It is. It's a barrier. It's hard to overcome. I've often said I wish I had learned Spanish when I was younger. Because we have so many Hispanic people in America, I would really have a leg up in any career that I went into if I could communicate in Spanish. That would make me valuable just to be able to communicate with Spanish-speaking people. As a preacher, if I could speak Spanish, it would greatly increase the effectiveness of my ministry. It would allow me to engage Spanish-speaking people. Paul said, though I spoke with the tongues of men, he's not talking about jibber-jabber. Paul said, if I could speak in Dutch, if I could speak in Portuguese, if I could speak in German, if I could speak in Chinese, if I could speak in Swahili, if I could speak in Afrikaans. He's saying, if I had this gift of speaking any number of languages, can you imagine if you were able to speak 7 or 8 languages and you were a preacher, an apostle, if you will, can you imagine the limitless ministry you would have? If I could speak those languages, I would go into every cultural restaurant in our area and I would talk to the people in their own language. I have found that people are partial to their own language. Have you noticed that? You ever go into a Chinese restaurant? The people there, if they're Chinese or they're Asian, they speak to one another, not in English. They speak in their home language. It's what they're most comfortable with. It's the same way if you go into a Mexican restaurant where there are Mexicans working there. They're speaking in Spanish back and forth. And I don't know what they're saying, so they're probably talking about me. In America, we used to get upset when we had to press 1 for English. Well, you know what? I think we were justified in being upset. This is our country. This is our language. And I think we ought to speak it. Have any of you ever been to Canada, a bilingual language country? You want to talk about an annoying place to fly through. You know how annoying it is when the lady or the stewardess gets up and buckles the seatbelt and puts the mask over? You hear that in 2 languages. You hear it first in English, then you hear it in French because they speak English and French. And so I'm sitting here going, oh gosh, we could have already flown had you people not adopted the stupid French language. Any of you speak French? None of you are mad at me then, good. It's as confusing when you're going down the highway as well. Everything's in kilometers. That's confusing to me anyways. But every sign has it in French and has it in English. And when you're driving at 105 kilometers an hour, I don't know how many miles that is, but 105 kilometers an hour, and you're trying to find the right exit, and every line you're reading is the French line, and you miss your exit, it's frustrating. But imagine how blessed you would be if you could speak both. You didn't have to see the English line. You could see any of it and get it. Paul said, oh, that I could speak in all these languages. And Paul could speak in a number of languages. He said, if I had this great gift, but he takes it a step further. The tongues of men and of angels. Now, there's a lot of debate here about what it means to speak in the tongues of angels. Some people say this is some higher heavenly language. Paul had been to heaven. Paul had seen things in heaven. He said he saw things and heard things that were not lawful to be repeated. So some people said, well, the tongues of angels is an illegal language. Let me give you my interpretation of what the tongues of angels mean. When angels speak, everyone understands them. The book of Revelation, we have an angel flying across heaven shouting, salvation to our God. We have an angel crying out over the earth, Babylon, the great whore, has fallen. When it cries out over the earth, everybody in every language understands exactly what the angel said all at one time. I do believe the tongues of angels were employed on the day of Pentecost when the apostles rose up and preached, and the people heard them in their own language, and they were preaching in their language. The tongues of angels are the same angels that came and spoke to all the people in the Bible, and they didn't change to speak in their language. They just spoke and were understood in the native language. I believe the tongues of angels have been employed in men before, Pentecost being that time. So when I look at this, Paul said, if I could speak in all languages, and I could have the gift of the angelic language, just to speak it the way I know it, and everybody hear it the way that they need to hear it, and everyone would get it, and it would be plain and simple. He said, if I had that God-given gift, and I didn't have any love, he said, I'd be as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Why is love so important, and without it, make someone that's so gifted worthless? You know what a sounding brass is? I thought a sounding brass and a cymbal were the same thing for years. A sounding brass is a trumpet. That's what it is. It's a trumpet. Now, we think of a trumpet like in the band where somebody would get up and play a trumpet solo, but they weren't that advanced in the first century. A trumpet was a noisemaker. That's all it was. It was for making noise. It wasn't used as a way of entertaining. It was used as a way of just making a loud sound. You would blow a ram's horn, that would be a shofar. But a brass horn had a different sound, and it was just used for making noise, a tinkling cymbal. Cymbals were not great musical instruments. They were occasionally used for that. But what's being described here is a clanging sound. You ever heard someone drive off? Remember back when people got married and they tied Coke cans and stuff to their car and clang, 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 clang all down the road? That's what's being described here. The clanging of a cymbal. Just a loud, clacking, clanging sound. Just the sound of a trumpet. A shrill, loud, high-pitched sound. Pagans would use the clanking of a cymbal and the blasting of a sounding brass to scare off evil spirits. The idea here was, if you make such a racket and such an annoying sound, the demonic spirits will eventually leave because they can't stand the noise you're making. Well, let me give you a little insight on demonic spirits. They thrive in noisy chaos. If you make noisy chaos, you're not running evil spirits off. You're catering to them. Okay? Let me apply that a little bit further. We have some people creating noise and chaos in America today, and God ain't on their side. He's never been on the side of noise and chaos. He's always been on the side of peace, liberty, and reason. Always been there. That didn't cost you anything. That's free of charge. Sounding brass, tinkling cymbal. If you have this great gift of communication that you can speak to anyone and everyone, and you don't have love in your heart, you're just a noisemaker. That's all you are. When I was studying this, I read a comment that someone else quoted by an illiterate preacher in England. And they said this guy was a great, great preacher and was full of wisdom, but he could not read, he could not write, he preached on portions of the Bible that people had read to him. And he preached on this passage. You know what he said after hearing this passage? He said he was sitting outside and he heard a wagon coming down the hill. And he said, man, it was noisy. He said it was screeching and squawking and the wheels were bouncing. He said the boards in the back of the wagon were just banging and clacking together. He said, my stars, what's going on? He went out and looked. He said the wagon was empty. Since there was no weight on it, the springs just jarred all the boards. And since there was no weight pressing down, holding it in contact with the ground, he said it was made the most awful racket. And he said behind it came a wagon fully loaded, and all you could hear was the axles turning and the picking up and putting down of the horse's hooves. You know what he said? The person who communicates without being filled with love is more noisy and more loud than the person who's filled with love. And the people who are noisy and loud and don't have love are of no use. They're an empty wagon. Folks, if an illiterate preacher can hear this verse read, look out at the road and understand it, you and I ought to understand the necessity of love for the people you're communicating to. You ever heard the old saying, some people love to hear themselves talk? Probably thought that. Might have even thought that about me. Now's not the time for a confession. That's not the kind of love we're talking about. The love that we're talking about is love for the people you're communicating with. The main ingredient in our communication must always be love. Number two, comprehension. See, communication, look at the first part of verse 2, we're going to see comprehension. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge. Stop there for just a moment. What does it mean to have the gift of comprehension? Well, the gift of prophecy. Prophecy here, as we said last week when we looked at these gifts in chapter 12, means two things. It can mean foretelling, as in telling the future, or forthtelling, as in telling or putting forth God's word. Paul said, though I have the gift of the proclamation of God's revelation. So Paul's referring to people who have the gift of preaching. But he takes it a step further. He says, in all knowledge and understand all mysteries. Now, the mysteries he's referring to are the Old Testament mysteries that are fulfilled in Christ. At the time of Paul writing this, people were still coming to understand what the Old Testament was describing. They were reading portions of the Old Testament that they had read over and over and over, and all of a sudden it clicked, it sunk in. Hey, Christ actually did that! And they were putting these mysteries together. They were putting together the mysteries of godliness, how God has built His church in Christ Jesus. Paul said, if I were a preacher and had the gift of putting forth God's Word, and I understood all the mysteries, in other words, I could explain everything in the Bible, and all knowledge. Knowledge is an important thing. Knowledge here is referring to understanding of how things work. It's one thing to have the instruction book and read it and go, here's how you do it. It's another to actually put things together. Have you noticed that in your own life? The guy on YouTube made it look so easy. He changed that part out in his washing machine in 3 minutes. I've been here for 2.5 hours and I can't put it back together. Knowledge is understanding intimately how things go together. How things are put together. Paul said, if I'm a preacher and I'm a theologian and I'm a person who understands people and I don't love them, I've wasted my calling, I've wasted my gift, and I am not profitable at all. Can I tell you something? I know people who fit this category in the ministry. They're great preachers. I mean, I look up to them. I hear them preach. I think, my, how in the world did they ever... I mean, the way their message went together, the illustrations they used, the outlines they used. Oh, this person, I would love for them to be my pastor. I think of theologians that know all mysteries. I mean, I can read a couple verses of Scripture, and well, I don't get much out of that, but I can go over to my bookshelf and put my finger on a book and pull it out. And on those two verses, some theologian might write 4 or 5 pages worth of insight. And I can read that and just marvel and go, how did this guy, in the 1600s, without any internet, without anything else to look up, come up with all of this? I'll never have that kind of understanding of the mysteries of God. But if that person doesn't have love, what good is it? understanding. Some people know how to manipulate people. They know how to work with people. They know how to get along with people. They are great organizers. But if they don't have love and they're not driven by love, they're useless. Folks, I'm here to tell you, a great pastor is not someone that is just merely good at prophecy, understanding mysteries and knowledge. A great pastor has to have love. The greatest pastor I know, the greatest pastor I personally know, is a horrible preacher, a horrible theologian. I don't really think he understands what the pastorate's all about. But I don't know of any other preacher that loves his people more than this guy loves his church, the church he pastors. When his people go out of town, he goes to their home and feeds their dog for them. When a storm comes through the next morning, you can call this preacher up and say, "Hey, did you get any storm damage?" "No, my house is fine." "Well, what are you doing? Sound like the wind's blowing." "Oh, I'm over here in one of the Sunday school teachers' top of their house putting some shingles back for them." Shouldn't you be studying for your sermon? You're not a very good preacher. That'd be the worst advice I could give a guy that truly loved the people he pastored, wouldn't it? You know why he's such a great pastor? His people know that he loves them. He loves them, and that love is the main ingredient. And you can alter the amount of salt you put on it. You can alter the little amount of pepper you put on it. You can even alter the buttermilk you put in it. But if you don't have love, your comprehension doesn't impress anybody. You don't genuinely love the people that you've been called to minister to, it's of no use. Wasting your time. Look at what he says at the end of verse 2, "I am nothing." I am nothing. Some of the greatest theologians are also some of the proudest people I know. Not all of them. Some of them are. They know it. They teach seminary. They're over a lot of young, impressionable ministers. It goes to their head, and they really think they're somebody. They're super doctor, dean, professor, such and such of such and such school, and they have a credentials this long. Without love, they're nothing. Let's look at our third thought. We've seen communication. We've seen comprehension. Let's look at confidence, the latter part of verse 2. He says, "And though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing." Have all faith. Now, I want to talk for a moment about this. The word faith here doesn't mean all faith is in all salvation. We're saved by faith. Faith is our agent in which we access God's forgiveness through the work of Christ. But the faith that's mentioned here is the same faith that's talked about in chapter 12 in reference to miracles. Some people have the gift of faith. They believe the impossible, attempt the impossible, and accomplish the impossible. That is the faith that Paul is referencing here. He says the faith that moves mountains. Where Christ said, "If thou hast the faith of a grain of mustard seed, thou can say unto that mountain, be cast into the sea, and it will be done so." We have such a large group of people in our day that take that verse so far out of context. They'll tell you if you have enough faith, you just say something, and it happens. I still believe that the faith of the mustard seed carries a shovel if it's going to move a mountain. Faith is not in the mouth. The faith is in the hands. If the hands are silent and the mouth speaks, big deal. But who is it that decides they're going to push a mountain down into the sea? Who is it that makes this idea? It has to be someone with an extreme amount of confidence to even attempt it. The only way that someone would attempt the impossible is if God gave them the faith to do so, to embark on it. And when God puts it within your heart to accomplish something, to attempt something, to go to work at something, that's all you can think about. I think about what Scott Silvers told us a few Sunday nights ago. God impressed it upon him that he needed to go and minister to Indians in Oklahoma. And he said, "Man, I've got a good job. My wife and I have been married. We've got a kid in high school. I'm pretty comfortable. There's already people over there doing that. My home's paid for. I got a good job." Why in the world would he leave all that, leave his family, leave his home, go 600-800 miles away, and start all over again in life, living on faith? The only reason that Scott would attempt that is because God has given him the faith to attempt it. Paul said, if I had so much faith impressed upon me that I would be a mountain mover, and I did all that without genuine love for the people I was ministering to, I'm nothing. I'm nothing. Today people always talk about doing miracles. Most of your miracle workers today, quote-unquote miracle workers, they ain't really working miracles. They're what John MacArthur called hucksters of holiness. They're phonies. They're not motivated by love. They claim to be able to do miracles. They claim to have this faith-healing power. But if they were doing it for love, they wouldn't talk so much about sowing a seed of faith. Because by sowing a seed of faith, they mean put money in their pocket. When you're doing something out of a love-driven mindset, money is the last thing that you ever think about. But with these phony prophet miracle workers, money's all they talk about. That's the problem that we have today. When someone has been given the gift of confidence, go out and attempt the impossible. If they're doing that without genuine love for the people that they're attempting to accomplish this for. Look at our last one. I'm using the word charity because that's what Paul's talking about, charity. You look at verse 3, it says, though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity there means love. What does it mean to give all of our goods to the poor? In other words, I sold my home, sold my car, I cashed out my 401k, I sold all my possessions and belongings, and I took all that money and I gave it to the Salvation Army. I'm going to tell you what, if somebody did that, that'd be an internet sensation, wouldn't they? I bet they'd get 5,000 likes on Facebook. That's anytime some little heart-touching story. Can so-and-so get 5,000 likes for giving their bicycle up for Breast Cancer Awareness Week? I mean, oh yeah, some little kid does something sweet. Paul said, though I gave everything I owned up to help poor people. Then he goes a step further, and this is a puzzling phrase he uses here. Though I give my body to be burned. That word burned is only found here. And there's a lot of debate as to what it actually means. But I think I have some idea of what it means. It has the idea of boasting. If I give up everything to the point that it's noticeable, that it's evident, that it brings attention to me, that it reflects on me, and I don't do it out of love, it didn't profit me one bit. Let me explain it to you with a person that I know. This person's passed away now. So I don't know how you feel about talking about the dead, but it don't bother me a bit. I was getting a suit made one time, and church had given me some money, and I wanted to go over and get a really nice suit. So I went to a really nice store where they did suits. And the guy in there, he said, measuring me and everything, and he said, are you a doctor or a lawyer? I said, no, I'm a preacher. He said, oh, preacher. And he started telling me all the things that he did at his church. And all the money he had raised for this charitable organization and that charitable organization. And he was telling me about the money he had raised for downtown. He was telling me about the money he had raised for over here. And he was giving me a laundry list of great big accomplishments. And he stopped in the middle of telling me all the great things he's done with his life and said, you know what, if I don't call today, I'm not going to get my name on that plaque. Today's the deadline. He quit measuring my arms. He ran to the phone. He called some charity. He made sure his name was spelt right. He made sure his business was spelt right. I heard all this taking place. He come back and he said, be ashamed to give a couple $100 and not get credit for it. If all you're concerned about is getting credit for what you've done, you've wasted your money, you've wasted your time. I didn't know at the time why I heard all that. I didn't know at the time why this guy was bragging about all the stuff that he had done. But he was doing it so that he would have a good name in the community. He was doing it so his business would be recognized as on this group and that group. He was doing it for selfish gain. Paul's not talking about burning his body up. He's saying, I do things, I burn with zeal to be noticed, to be proud, to have a good name, to be recognized. I have seen people in the community help the boys' club out, give them money, give them product, and cuss them because their name got left off the banner out on the parking lot. Cuss them because their business was spelt wrong on the sign. Was it about putting your name on the sign or was it about the boys' club? Think about it. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have your name spelt right. I'm saying if you don't have love, keep your money. Spend it on yourself. You'll get more out of it. Because when you try to do charitable work without genuine love for the people you're trying to charitably help, you've wasted your money. How do you know I've wasted it, preacher? Verse 3 says so. It profiteth me nothing. Profiteth me nothing. You don't love the church and the people that you give your money to the Lord in, you're not getting anything out of it. I know people who say, I don't agree with our church. I don't like the people there. I don't like the pastor there. I don't like what they're doing. But I know I need to give my money to the Lord. You can't love the people you're entrusting your money to. You're not getting anything out of it. Honest to goodness. It's of no profit to you. It's useless. You've wasted your money. You've wasted your time. If you sincerely hate the people at Leaf Creek, don't give us another penny. Brother Harold, would you really say that? Absolutely. Go spend it on yourself. Maybe you'll get a better attitude. Come back and do it right the second time. But I know people who do more for charitable causes, more for all these things, and the real reason why they're doing it is so that they can be seen. They will literally wear themselves out. And they don't love the people they're doing it for. They love the attention they get. This is true of people in the church. It's true of preachers. There are preachers that will wear themselves out trying to get all the attention they can get, out doing good works. They don't love the people they're serving. They're wasting their time. They're wasting their energies. Why? Why? Because every single time you leave the main ingredient out of a recipe, you don't end up with the same outcome. When I look at this, I look at Paul in every instance. Communication, comprehension, confidence, charity, love has to be there. If it's not there, it's nothing. It's nothing. When you look at your life, ask yourself, why are you doing what you're doing? Well, preacher, I go to work to make money. Well, I would instruct you to learn to love what you do. You may never be able to do what you love. So learn to love what you do. The Bible instructs us to do everything that we do as unto the Lord. You know what that means? You're a cop. You've got to be a cop not like you're just serving the mayor or the police chief. You've got to be a cop like Jesus is the boss. You're a fireman, same way. You build houses. If you're a plumber and you unstop toilets, it ought to be like every toilet, Jesus' toilet. You ought to take the same care and compassion and concern with it. And you ought to do it out of love and service to your fellow man. You say, well, Brother Harold, I work in a factory. I don't do services for my fellow man. Whatever it is you're making in that factory, your fellow man's using it. You ought to be doing it out of love. What about your home? Do you genuinely love your spouse? Do you genuinely love your children? What about your neighbors? Sometimes you just cut their grass because it's tall, not because you love them. Develop a loving relationship with your neighbors. And when you do something good for them, don't do it because you have to. Do it because you love them. An old saying that says, well, I know one of these days when I get in heaven, I'll be rewarded for all the good deeds I've done. They're only good deeds if they're done in love. Well, I have to go down to the church and do this. I have to go. Don't do it. Don't do it. We've got to. No, don't do it. If you've tormented and tortured into doing something, stop it. You're not doing it out of love. You've wasted your time. If I ever get to the point where on a Sunday morning I get up out of bed and go, I have to go preach today, fire me. Fire me. If I ever get up on a Sunday morning and go, well, I have to go down to Lee Creek and see all them people today, call me in the office and can me. Know why? I'm wasting my time. And if I'm wasting my time, I'm wasting your time. The main ingredient in everything the Christian does is love. I preached a message at the Preachers of Grace Conference called The Forgotten Requirement of Pastors. You know what it was? Love. I know a ton of preachers that really know their Bible. They're great preachers. They do a great job at delivering sermons, but they don't love their people. They're constantly looking for a better and bigger church. And as soon as one shows up on the scene, they change churches every 2 or 3 years. Some less than that. You're never, ever going to impact anyone's life unless you first love them. I got a great doctor. He loves me. He don't walk in the office. I don't see him very often anyways, and I see him more as a friend than I see him in his office. But he don't walk in there and look at his clock and go, there's 5 patients after you. We need to hurry, bud. We need to go. What's the matter? Quick, tell me. He's not turning my head around looking in both. He's not in a hurry. Why? He likes me. He walks in and goes, hey, what are you doing? How's it going? After a few minutes conversation, he says, looks here on your chart, you got these problems. Have you tried? It's conversation. You know why? He loves what he's doing. You ever been to a doctor that was good at what he did, but he didn't like people? He didn't love people. He didn't have a desire to love them. It's hard to communicate. It's hard to communicate. It's hard to tell him what's really happening on the inside of you when he's thinking about 3 patients down where he's going. Christian, if you're interacting with your fellow Christian that way, you're not accomplishing anything. Christian, if you're living your day-to-day life, serving yourself, going through the motions, doing the bare minimum without love, you're going to enter heaven with a big shock on your face. It's not going to send you to hell. It's just going to render a lot of what you thought was good service to the Lord is unprofitable and useless because it didn't have love. You're trying to serve the Lord without love. You're not serving the Lord at all. Paul had just gave this laundry list of great gifts that God had given the church. Every one of you in this church has been given great gifts from God. But if you are employing your God-given gifts without love and compassion for your fellow man, you're wasting your time. One thing I want to say about Lee Creek, I wrote it down, I put it in the bulletin, I thought about it this week. Lee Creek's a loving church. You genuinely love each other. So Brother Harold, how do you know that we love each other? Because when something happens to one of you, the rest of you are interested in what's happening. How are they doing? Someone's missing for a couple Sundays. I may not even notice it. I've got to look at a lot of different faces. I talk to a lot of different people. I get sidelined. I get cornered. I get distracted. But you don't. You know why? You love that person. You're looking forward to talking to that person. You're interested in their life. If something's wrong and you think something's wrong, people come to me and say, hey, is everything okay with so-and-so? I'm like, I don't know. That love is seen. That love is real. And that love is not found in every church. But it's here. It's here. And it's not here because you're good and I'm good. It's here because God has put it in our hearts. And we express what God has put in our hearts. Okay? I'm not trying to tell you y'all need to love each other. You do. But I am going to give you a word of caution. You ready? If you ever stop loving one another, you're going to have problems. The moment that you're no longer driven by love is when there's going to be problems in the church. The moment that love don't cover a multitude of transgressions is when some little something that somebody said is going to get under your skin and there's going to be turmoil. I'm not saying you don't love each other. I'm saying the moment that we stop loving each other, you're going to experience as a church what it's like in a group of people when their gifts are not employed with love. My prayer is this, that every time, always, we employ our gifts with love, mine included. If I'm up here preaching out of anger because I don't like the way you're acting or something you said, I've wasted my time and I've wasted yours. So let's all strive to continue to serve one another with love. Amen.